Hello, everyone, and welcome to Talk Nerdy. Today is Monday, July 19th, 2021, and I'm the host of the show, Cara Santa Maria. And whew, it's been a rough summer so far. I think that, COVID is still nagging. COVID is still very much here. A lot of us are really tired. I'm also, just so that you guys know where I'm at, I sometimes talk about my work on the show, but in the intro, I don't talk about kind of where I'm at with things. I am pushing through to finish my qualifying examination and my dissertation proposal for my PhD program. And so if you know anybody or you yourself have gone through this process, you know that it can be really grueling. This is one of those important kind of rate limiting steps. And oof, today's a day. It's been a doozy, but I'm really excited about the newest episode. I cannot believe that I've managed to put out an episode every week. It's been tough to do, but gosh, isn't this one important? Before we dive into this week's episode with Dina Pyro, I do want to talk to you a little bit about, not talk to you, that sounds very stern. Let's have a chat, you guys. I want to thank those of you who continue to make the show possible. You know, you're between my ad sales and the pledges from all of you who do so, this is what makes me just enough money to be able to keep producing this show each week, because I do pay an editor and I do pay my incredible assistant, Noelle Dilworth, who helps keep the calendars, book the episodes, and just manage all of the things that go into producing a show every single week, on top of working on The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, lately doing some work on god-awful movies, seeing patients every week at the cancer center where I work, doing all of my coursework, and of course doing a daily TV show for PBS and KCET called SoCal Update about our local California market and some of the important news that's going on there. So, oh my gosh, I need to go to sleep. But before I do want to thank those of you who kind of are keeping food in my mouth and a roof above my head. And they include Mary Neva, Rob Schreck, Pasquale Gelati, Brian Holden, Christopher Pitts, Daniel Lang, David J.E. Smith, Dudas Infinitas, June Sapara, Ulrika Hagman, Robert Christ, Charles Bleel, I think it is, maybe it's Blell, and many, many, many more. Thank you all so much from the bottom of my heart. All right, let's dive into this week's show. So I had the incredible opportunity to sit down with a diversity and equity strategist. Her name is Dina Pyro, and she is the founder of a STEM program for youth of color called iUrban Teen. She also recently co-founded and launched Black Women in STEM 2.0. She served on a ton of boards, different commissions. She had a gubernatorial appointment to the Commission on African American Affairs in Washington State. And she was even honored by President Barack Obama as a White House champion of change for technology inclusion. She's doing really, really important work. And I think that she does an incredible job of opening our eyes to some of the challenges that are facing many Americans today, and how we can promote more equity, inclusion, and celebration of diverse voices, both in education and within the workforce. So without any further ado, here she is, Dina Pyro. Well, Dina, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. So it is a fine Monday morning that we are recording this podcast. And I, of course, am coming in from Los Angeles. And you are where? In Seattle?
I'm up in Seattle, the great Emerald City.
Love it. And so between us, there are many miles and many fires, unfortunately, right now.
I hate it.
I know. Yeah. Is the air pretty clear where you are, at least? Are you able to breathe? Because I know that it's pretty smoky for a lot of people who are in Northern California, pretty much all of Oregon and parts of Washington, too.
Wow. No, it's perfectly clear here. And I hope it stays that way. You know, I wasn't even aware of all the fires going on, perhaps in Oregon. I just know that last year and the year before, both California and Oregon and Eastern Washington was just inundated with these wildfires. And you know, because of climate change, it's getting worse and worse. You know, this heat, the droughts, it's kind of scary.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's a tough time right now for a lot of folks. And we also know that because of climate change, but also because of the social inequity built into our you know, social structures here in the U.S., people of color, people of a lower SES tend to, unfortunately, get hit much harder by these problems like climate change. And that's, you know, that is the unfortunate nature of the kind of racist structure that our society was built upon. And of course, you are working hard to combat some of these concerns. So I want to dive right in with the work that you do, because I think it's really important. I think it's something that I'm not sure that we've taken the time very often on Talk Nerdy to highlight. We often talk about the problems that exist. We don't often talk about the solutions that are available. So yeah, I'm wondering how to even get started. Was tell me a little bit about, I guess, about how you became a diversity strategist. That might be a good place to start.
Well, you know, oh God, if the story goes, I moved up to the Pacific Northwest, to Portland, from Compton, California, back in the early 1990s. And I instantly felt this thing. I felt othered. I felt this disparity amongst people of color and dominant culture folks here, even though it was this weird sense of liberalism, but it was still not equitable. And so I instantly felt that. I could see it in front of my eyes. I don't know how many times I was called the N-word, which never happened to me in public anywhere in California. So when I was working at the city of Portland, I can instantly see the inequities, you know, especially with people of color and them feeling voiceless. I was one that I have always been, well, let's put it this way. I can't fathom not having my voice heard. I have that much confidence where I am going to be a presence in a room. I don't care what color I am. And so soon, a lot of people there, folks of color, you know, would come to me and ask me if I could ask their boss if they could do something, if they could attend one of my diversity sessions, if they can do this or that. And I would say, no, you can ask them. And this is what you say and how you say it. And they still wouldn't ask. That bothered me. And it bothers me to this day. And that was in the early 90s. And so I felt that I really need to start advocating for others who felt voiceless there at the city. So that started my journey into the whole equity, inclusion pieces of this work. So I was able to create a lot of different initiatives. And one way that I felt to see that, to move the needle on diversifying more of the supervisory management ranks, was I created a diversity and mentoring program that was for women and people of color, employees of color. It was a year-long facilitated mentoring program to try to level set that inequity. I created their affinity groups or their employee resource groups back in the early 2000s. That's still going strong now. So, you know, one of the things that it taught me, Cara, was early on that I'm an entrepreneur. You know, entrepreneurs always look at things to fix and create something to fix it, you know, to fill this void. It wasn't until the early 2000s that I realized this need to come in and change and create things consistently, especially in the structures like government, which, you know, everything moves like a snail's pace, which just about drove me crazy. But that's when I started realizing I was an entrepreneur, you know, was those kind of experiences. So anyway, those roles kind of led me into working as a commissioner here in the state of Washington. So I served on the governor's Commission on African American Affairs for about 6 or 7 years. And I'm kind of segueing into iUrbanTeen. And so on that commission, all of our ethnic commissions were talking about the opportunity gap, especially for male youth of color who were being marginalized, disenfranchised, you know, falling through the cracks, not having a clear pathway or support mechanisms in place. And so at the time, I was living in Vancouver, Washington, so Southwest Washington, and I immediately started thinking about what can I do to put a dent in this? So a lot of our families, I learned about the Running Start program, where the Running Start program is where students in high school in their junior year can go to both high school and the local community college. So by the time they graduate high school, not only are they graduating with a high school diploma, but also with an associate's degree.
Oh, I love that. You know, I did something similar to that for my senior year of college, but it wasn't a formal program. It was just some, I think, creative and angsty teen frustration. Yeah. I mean, I think I remember going with my mom to our guidance counselor at my high school, and I was, you know, smoking a lot of weed. I was like frustrated with school. And I remember just going and being like, I'm leaving. I can't do this anymore. I only have 2 credits left. I'm really frustrated. Like I'm hating my classes. Like I think I might drop out and just get a GED. And they were like, no, you're not doing that. And so they did. They offered me a creative solution, which was that the 2 credits that I had left in high school, I could actually take at the collegiate level. And during my senior year, it was also my freshman year of college. And they said, take a full load on top of that, and we'll give you high school credit for those classes. And but you'll also have a year of college classes under your belt just at the local community college. And it was probably the best thing I could have done for myself at that time. It kind of saved me.
Wow. That sounds great. Mm-hmm. You know if they still do that?
I don't even know if it was a structured program. I was living in Texas at the time, and it was just, I guess, a flexible thing that my high school offered to me. Hopefully there are a lot of creative and flexible solutions being offered to a lot of kids right now, because, you know, you add to it all of the difficulties that you were seeing with a lack of equity of opportunity. Now you add to that the crushing difficulty of COVID.
I know. And that gap, right? That educational gap that we're trying to fill, you know, right now. But yeah, it's challenging. And so I'm always trying to think of creative ways to how do we, one, partner with local community colleges and universities to give them those opportunities of credits.
Right. And what a brilliant program to have that kind of formalized and institutionalized and offered to kids at the high school level I do think there's a certain point when kids come from sometimes, I don't even want to say neighborhoods, quote unquote, but like when they come from upbringings where they've been asked to be adults, where they've been forced, not even asked, but forced to take on adult roles, to work jobs, to help raise their siblings, to help pick up the slack. Oftentimes, by the time they're hitting their 17th, 18th year, they are starting to feel very boxed in a high school setting. And college offers them a little bit of that freedom and a little bit of massaging of that part of them that feels very adult and feels ready to sort of be in the world. And I think if you miss that opportunity, it's much more likely that a kid, and I mean, at this point, we couldn't even really call them kids, is just going to enter into the workforce, probably, sadly, in a low-skilled position and say, you know, I see that this has more immediate benefit for me than going to college.
And see, that's what we're trying to avoid. We're really trying to segue them in to different experience. So we end up hiring a lot of our high school students to work as interns with us. So they're actually helping with our programs and working with other teams and getting paid for it. You know, the things that we do too is we also have most of our programs on college and university campuses. So they can feel that experience, you know, and breathe it in and get used to it. So we let them be kids, and we ourselves, I think we act like big kids. I know I do, you know, around them. I really do. I enjoy being around them. We love brainstorming with them, collaborating with them, and all of that, and letting them see all of the opportunities. I always, you know, for me myself, I've always been idealistic and optimistic. I'm one of those types, right? I think if I would have been Dorothy in the Wizard of Oz, that would have been perfect for me. But we keep that open. But going back to that Running Start program, where I was talking about when I was a commissioner and found out about it and this great opportunity, but the inequity of it was the high school counselors weren't telling our Black and Brown families about it. And so one key thing when I found that out, that a lot of our families didn't even know about it, was being that information sharer, that bridge, where we were sharing that information. We were trying to assist and help those kids take that COMPAS test to even get into the program. So those kind of things and those kind of inequities was what I saw such a need for programs like mine. And so, yeah. And so, again, that inequity piece, when we talk about equity and inclusion and all, everything I do with iUrban Teen, with Black Women in STEM, with my diversity keynotes, everything is centered and anchored around equity and inclusion.
Yeah. And so I'm interested in the sort of transition then from, you know, working as, you know, a commissioner and aiding in sort of academic equity, sort of the transition that brought you to really focus specifically on science, technology, engineering, and math. You know, where did you see that need and what sort of compelled you to then say, okay, I would like to focus and really start to develop and work towards some programs that help improve opportunities for kids and adults in these specific areas?
Well, it again, when I was, you know, back in the day or back in like 2010 or 2009 or so, I was asked to participate on a Chief Information Officer Council in Portland. And I told my friend who invited me to be, you know, to participate on this, I said, but I'm not a CIO. And he goes, I know, but you're innovative and we need you. We need your voice. So I appreciated that. And so when I went to the very first meeting, I walked into the room and it was a room full of white men. I was it for diversity. I couldn't believe it. And so when I went to the front of the room and sat down, and I did that on purpose too, because a lot of times we as women and people of color, we will sit in the back of the room, not to be seen, not to be, you just be quiet. I'm in a room. So I walk straight to the, I know, I'm like, I'm here. So I went straight to the front. I asked two of the guys that were there to move over. I mean, there were table rounds. There was enough space to get another chair there. I asked them to move over so I can get a chair here. And they politely moved over and I pulled a chair up right there and right in front. And, so as soon as the meeting started back again, I started realizing I'm it for diversity, but this room, I said, so over here, we've got these youth being marginalized, disenfranchised, clearly not a clear pathway. But here in this room with all these technologists and STEM professionals is where the opportunities are. So how do I bridge this divide? And so 6 months later, with the help of some of those men in the room, I launched iUrban Teen, you know, on the campus of Washington State University in October 2011. We're coming up on our 10th year anniversary in October. And I knew from the very first event that we had to keep going because there was something magical that I saw happening. I ensured that we had engaging, hands-on, fast-paced activities because I knew I had to grab them quickly. And that's still how we operate now. Very hands-on, interactive, brainstorming, collaborative learning, you know, where kids are learning in teams, etc. And so that's what segued me in was being asked to participate on that Chief Information Officer Council, realizing that there was no diversity in that space. But it was so many opportunities in that space and that our kids and families weren't aware of these opportunities. So again, that's where I made the connection and the rest is history. Now we're in Seattle, Portland, Los Angeles, Dallas, Houston. We're getting ready to launch in Harlem, you know, hopefully by the end of summer. If not, it'll be in 2022. And also we're looking to launch in London in 2022 as well.
So it really was about, for you, and continues to be about the fact that you see earning potential. You see a potential for, you know, there's like a real potential for job opportunities in the STEM space. This is it's not just the present, it's the future. But if we don't have the right training and we don't have the right, not just the right training, but if we don't have the awareness, I mean, that's really step one, right? It's just a fundamental awareness.
Yeah, step one is the awareness. And you know, there are a lot of low opportunity white youth that don't have the awareness either. And so even though we have an intentional reach to male youth of color, more than 50% of our student population now are girls. We also work with youth with disabilities, especially on the autism spectrum. And we also have some low opportunity white youth that participate in our programs. Everything is free, you know, what we do. So, we never turn away any child that wants to participate and wants to learn. I don't believe in siloing a program or only have it geared for one demographic.
Right. And so how do you fund it? If this is offered for free for all, you know, youth, how do you fund these programs? I mean, are these scholarships that are available to individuals? Obviously, you have a lot of different types of programs, which we'll dive into. But is this really about just doing a lot of fundraising on your part?
Girl, honey, let me tell you, this has been a heavy lift. Oh my God. And there is truth, and I say it every time, with being a Black female founder, especially in the STEM space. Mm-hmm. We weren't funded for 9 years. Mm-hmm. And I was honored by President Obama as a White House Champion of Change for Technology Inclusion back in 2013 and invited back 3 more times during his presidency. But the first time there, and I don't have any filters, by the way, so I hope I don't offend anybody.
That's cool. That's where we're offend, but we are not too concerned about that here on my show.
Okay, cool. So at the end of the day, when it was 7 of us being honored as White House Champions of Change for Technology Inclusion, at the end of the day, they asked us, well, what are some of the real challenges that you guys are facing? And I said, well, I'm going to be very honest and transparent. Mine is funding. I'm a woman of color with a program that's making an impact in the community, but I'm not funded. I could be a white girl selling cat booties and I'd be funded hand over foot. There's a lot of salaries being made off the backs of Black and brown youth in this country by dominant culture organizations who truly are not making the impact that they could. But funding or no funding, we're here for the long game. You know, our kids are used to people coming into the community, cherry picking, getting money and gone. That's not us. I could pull a rabbit out of my hat like nobody can. And Kyra, I was pulling rabbits out for 9 years. I almost lost my house at one point trying to fund this program myself. And it wasn't until about a year and a half ago, Bobby Wagner of the Seahawks heard about us. I was talking to him. He loved the program. And I said, yeah, but the only problem is it's hard. It's a heavy lift because we're not funded. And he said, right now you're not, but you will be. So he selected us as his nonprofit of choice for this contest that the Seahawks were having, and he won. So a bunch of money came our way because of him. And it's interesting how money begets money, because after that, and people saw Seahawks, Irvington, who's Irvington? Then other companies came forward with funding. So we have been blessed, truly blessed, to have the support of companies like Lamb Research out of California, Microsoft, Nike, Intel, got Nintendo, Oregon Community Foundation, and got Southwest Washington Community Foundation. So we have been blessed and honored to receive this funding and a lot of personal donations, especially after George Floyd. After George Floyd's murder, we had a ton of private donors donating to us, which I was appreciative, but I'm going, where were you like 2 years ago? You know, but but they did. So I am finally was able to hire staff because it was just me doing all this, being the Pied Piper for so many years. But I was determined to push this program through because I could see the impact, Cara. When I would be there and you would see a child, especially one of our young Black male youth that would come to our program for the first time, and they would already look broken. You know, they would already look like they have the weight of the world on their shoulders.
Even though they're like 14, 15, 16.
12 years old. And that's why I said, I don't care. We're going to keep doing what we do because they feel comfortable. They feel safe within our program. And we honor them. You know, we truly do. We never call our student population at risk or any of those things. You know, I say historically excluded.
Yeah.
But I also say the only label I have for them is brilliant.
Ugh. I love that. And I think that that is so important. And I've been seeing a growing movement for that online for sort of even just changing the very basic turn of phrase that we use to take the onus off of. Like, I remember seeing a meme that was going around where it was like, maybe instead of talking about imposter syndrome, we should be, you know, maybe it's not that I, as you know, a young woman of color in STEM, have imposter syndrome. Maybe the issue is that I've been historically excluded. Maybe the issue is that I've been made to feel like I don't have space here, made to feel like I don't have a voice. You know, how else am I of course going to feel? And so you're right, I think this idea of like at risk, it puts the onus on the kid.
Yeah.
As opposed to saying historically excluded.
Yeah. At risk, underprivileged, all that stuff. It's like you expect to see some child that's like starving somewhere or whatever. And I'm like, that's not our kids.
And that somehow like the kid or the kid's family is choosing to do something to keep themselves in some kind of way, as opposed to the fact that, like, no matter what they do, there are structures in place, you know, that are promoting this continued disenfranchisement.
And you know that thing that words and labels can be so strong, right? And they can have such a negative impact. I always say you lift up communities, help lift up that community. You know, the other thing too is we're totally family focused. We did that from day one. So you might come to our event, you might see grandparents there supporting that child, you know, the parent, the aunt, the uncle, the big brother, the sister, the cousin. You know, I always say you honor the families by inviting them in. So because we didn't have funding for so many years, it was the families that saw the value, that were there helping me whatever way they could, getting those kids there and continuing the conversations. So the parents and families were learning right along with the student. And there have been several parents and adults that have gone back to school because of something they learned, you know, by participating in iUrban Teen.
So tell me a little bit about what's actually going on within the program. So we talked about, you know, these struggles for funding, but then, you know, beyond that, that's happening obviously on the back end that the kids aren't necessarily able to see. What is it that the kids see when they discover iUrban Teen and they start to engage?
Oh, wow. We want to first make sure that they have a fun experience in learning. And I always do think that's kind of like a multi-tiered approach to learning. One example is because we have so many programs. We have our iEngineer program that's a multi-year pathway for Black and Indigenous youth into engineering careers. We have our iBuild program, which is advanced manufacturing and supply chain. Because we're more than just a coding program. We do have coding, but we have cybersecurity. We have writing, both creative and technical writing programs. We have our iSpeak program, which is the art of public speaking. That's one of my favorites because once they get that confidence build in speaking and speaking in front of a group, in front of a class, you know, it's very important. You can see the confidence boost all along the way for them. But ours is a different tier to it. Yes, it's the art of public speaking and all that and skills, But tier two of that is using your voice for conflict resolution, using your voice for interviewing and negotiating. So those life skills, you know, too, that stay with them. We have our music and math program, which is a different way at looking at math. They're learning and creating digital beats, but learning the math in that beat as well. So looking at math differently. We have another program that I love. It's our IMAP program, which is GIS mapping and machine learning attached to a research project. So the first cohort we had was IMAP Health, where I told Microsoft and Cigna, not only are these kids going to be learning these technology tools of GIS mapping and machine learning and data analytics, but they're also going to be researching a health disparity that's affecting their families and their communities. We had them focus on diabetes, you know, because I said they're going to be researching this and understanding it, and then also looking at how can I change the narrative of this, which is very important. So we had our IMAP environmental, which we had them focus on climate change, right? So now the next cohort, which will be live because everything was virtual before, this next one is going to focus on sickle cell, which is also a health inequity because there's not enough dollars going into the research or funding for sickle cell because it's a Black blood disorder, right? So everything that we do is interesting. It's deep, but we make it a fun learning experience for them, you know, for both middle school and high school. Now we have so many students that have gone through Irvine Teen that are in college or adults that still want to stay tethered to us. So we created iUrban University, you know, for more for our students that were over 18 and have transitioned out of high school.
It seems to me like one of the most important aspects, obviously, other than the exposure, the training, the awareness, all of these are like equally important, is the idea of mentorship. It's the idea of seeing people who are from your community, seeing people who have a similar background, who talk like you, who look like you, who sound like you, and who have had, unfortunately, probably not good opportunities, but fought through or were very lucky or for whatever reason, managed to embody the position, whether it be becoming an engineer, becoming a computer scientist, becoming a whatever, to embody those positions. Because if we see people in those positions that look and sound like us, then we can see ourselves doing those things when we get older.
Totally agree. And that's why I was always reaching out to, you know, different employee resource groups, you know, Black and Latinx resource groups at Intel, Microsoft, Nintendo, et cetera, so that they could come volunteer at our event so that these kids could see them. And I remember one time we had at one of our first or second events back in like 2012 or so, we had the whole employee resource group or a lot of the employee resource group, Black resource group from Intel, and they were both mainly engineers, come and set up these tables, info tables, to show the kids these different programs. And I remember looking at our students, our 12, 13, 14-year-olds, that were just kind of looking at them in amazement. They were more amazed at them than the program they were trying to show them. And that is the beauty of it, so that they can see that they too can be that. They can get there, you know, as well, and see their own imagery in those roles.
Yeah, no, it's so fundamental, right? And it's like we talk about all these first steps, but it's like if you don't have that, then you're expecting that kid to carry a lot. I mean, we're already expecting these kids to carry the world on their shoulders. They already do, to push through these barriers, to have the sort of moxie and the gumption and the foresight to say, this is something that I can do. This is something that is available to me. But to expect that, I mean, to expect that is so grand, but to expect that where all they ever see are white men in these roles is, I mean, basically insurmountable. And I'm in awe of the, for example, Black women who have come before these, you know, when we're looking at the record, I mean, it was few and far between, but the handful of trailblazing individuals who actually did push through all of those barriers. I mean, obviously, we're still continuing to push through these barriers. But when you see these people doing this in the 40s, in the 50s, in the 60s, I mean, it blows my mind that it was even possible. I mean, it's barely possible.
That we're just learning about them. And just think about how many others that we haven't discovered yet, you know, that were trailblazing back then. It always blows my mind. But, you know, I also have to admit and say that some of my biggest supporters in this program, you know, that are really authentically vested in this program to make a change are white men.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
Yeah. Isn't that interesting? Well, you know, I was doing a diversity chat up at Western Washington University about a year and a half ago. They wanted me to come up and do a keynote, and I thought I was going to be instructors and community members. But when I got there, 90% of the audience were student, you know, population. They weren't getting any extra credit to come listening to me or anything. And out of that 90% student population, 85% were white male students. And so I started talking and I had to stop. I said, you know what? I got to address something here in the room.
Yeah.
And so I said, there's a lot of you young white male students here and you're not getting credit to come listening to me. So I went and sat down next to one of them with the mic. And I said, so tell me, why are you here? And he said, well, because I want to be a part of the solution, not part of the problem. So I've always been vested in self-growth and self-discovery to being a part of the future. And so all the other white males are shaking their head like, yes. And so I went over to another one and I said, okay, so what's your story? And he said, well, you know, I grew up in an environment that was all white and I kept hearing these things about other people that didn't strike me the right way. And so I did my own walk through this and felt that, you know, that how unfair it was. And so like him, I also want to be a part of the solution, not the problem. You know, I left that day when I left and finished my keynote, I felt so encouraged about the future. I think that this next generation is going to be real game changers for us, you know, as far as what they're looking to do. And, you know, I also did working with a global tech company. Everything was virtual because of COVID, but they wanted to make some inroads and changes within the organization. Already good organization, but every organization, every person has room to grow. So they wanted me to talk to their team and all. And then they sent out an interest form for any of their staff that want to participate on revisiting and relooking at their policies and things and make them more equitable. And so there was about 40 employees from all over the globe. I'm talking about, you know, England, Australia, Ireland, you know, Portugal, United States, that were on that info call. And the majority of them were white men, you know. And then I let them tell their story because I wanted to know their why, you know. Why are you vested in this? Why do you? And I tell every organization, for me, I take this work so seriously. I've been doing it for so long. I don't have time for passive conversations. You know, anything I do with you has to be action oriented, you know, everything. And they knew that. And I'm so proud of the work that they've done, you know. And I, again, on the call with them, I said, you know what I noticed? There's a whole bloody white guys on here.
Yeah.
Well, so I said, so tell me your story. You know, what's your why? Why do you want to be a part of this change and impact? And I listened to their stories and they were so heartfelt and they were so authentic, you know, that I knew that they intrinsically wanted to make a change. So I, like I said, I think that we are at this turning point, that we have to keep this moving forward, not lose that momentum that we gained in 2020 on this whole space of equity and inclusion. Because I think that 2020 was a true game changer and an eye opener for a whole lot of folks.
Yeah. And I think it's really encouraging to hear that. And I mean, I think I've always known that there were many, many allies, but to hear about the growing and increasing drive to affect change in the hearts of the very people who benefit most from the privilege of the way that the systems are currently structured. Because the truth of the matter is, and I mean, I know this being a woman in STEM, there are times when you're in a room where there are not a lot of other women and you say something and that thing goes unheard. And then, you know, it becomes, as the phrasing goes, bro-appropriated by another individual. And then all of a sudden it's a great idea. And we know that because by the very nature of the structures being continuing to be held by individuals in power, and that those individuals have long been, unfortunately, white men, that until the very people in those positions of power, like there's two ways to go about this, right? It's to usurp that power, or it's to work with the stakeholders to change the makeup. It's to change the makeup of the boardrooms. It's to change the makeup of the, you know, council. And, you know, I think that obviously a much more accelerated path to equity of opportunity is that we're affecting change from both sides.
Yep. From both sides. Yeah, that's what it takes. But I'm, you know, again, remember I said I was that optimistic, idealistic person. I do feel that there's a shift that's occurring. You know, we just have to make sure that we keep moving forward and not be afraid to have these conversations, and that we ourselves as women and people of color, how do we make sure that our voices are heard, you know, because it can be scary when you're the only one in a whole group, right? In a whole dominant culture, male-centered group, it can be intimidating. You know, but it's one of the things, like one of our students now who is majoring in cybersecurity at the University of Washington, I was so proud. He was being interviewed and by someone that wanted some more from a student's point of view on iUrbanTeen. And she called me and said that you'd be proud of him. He said that Ms. Dina teaches us how to be in a room when no one else looks like you and still be confident.
Right. Yeah, because they're going to, I mean, that's the sad thing, but there's going to be a lot of times where that's necessary.
That's so many times. I can't see another generation suffering in silence and not being, and being afraid to speak up and advocate for themselves in the workplace and in life.
Yeah. And so, you know, you've put so much effort into this area, this cross-section of need that you saw in sort of in young Black boys. Obviously, that has broadened to include any students who are really struggling, who have been excluded from the conversation and from the resources that have been available. But then you saw a need after that for individuals who have already gone through those hoops, who have secured those positions, and who are continuing to struggle with these pressures. And that's, of course, Black women in STEM 2.0. So I'm really interested to hear how Black women in STEM 2.0 came about.
Well, you know, we had, there was a group out of California that I encouraged to have a conference here in Seattle, and it was Black Women in Technology, and very successful event. And there was this thing I could feel, especially in places where the numbers are lower, like in the Pacific Northwest for Black women, especially Black women in STEM, in technology. And so we felt this vibe that was happening, that these women, you know, Black, brown, white, were so happy to be in this sense of this community, right? This communal type of thing where they felt supported, plus so many dynamic workshops. So after that first event, that was in October of one year, then at following January, my colleagues and I decided to let's broaden this, because there's also Black women in supply chain. There's Black women in manufacturing. There's Black women in engineering. So we wanted to change it to STEM, Black women in STEM. And we call it STEM 2.0 because the M in STEM, and same for iUrbanTeen, stands for manufacturing, not math. because math is interwoven in everything anyway. You think about it. It's all interwoven. And a lot of times manufacturing is left out. So we include the manufacturing piece. And so we wanted to keep something going with that. And so it was January 2019 is when we really kicked it off, and we had different live events, different panel sessions in partnership with companies like Google and Amazon and Microsoft and such. And so we had these panel discussions here in Seattle, Portland, Dallas, and Washington, D.C. And we were planning for our, and then we had a big summit in Portland that was huge. And it was, I mean, it was sold out. It was amazing. The same kind of sense of community that all of the women felt and loved. I also attached our Irvin Teen program to that summit because we have our girls pitch competition that happens every year during the summit, which will happen. We're having another summit here in Seattle area in October 22nd and 23rd, which will be a live in-person event. No more virtual stuff. Yeah. I'm like, no more.
I know. It's like, it's time. We need to re-enter into the world.
I know, before we go around like a bunch of zombies.
Uh-huh.
But of course, we were supposed to have the summit last year in Dallas, but COVID hit. And so we had to do everything virtual. So we didn't have a summit, but now we are having our second one here in Seattle in October. But anyway, so we felt a strong need for that. Plus, I wanted a community of Black and Brown women to be able to help mentor our girls who are in Irvin Teen. So for me, it's a win-win. One, we're building the sense of community and information share for women, women of color in STEM. But also, these women are going to give back and help our girls in Irvin Teen.
Yeah, I love that. And I think, you know, it's this balance that has to be played between being aspirational without being Pollyanna-ish, being motivating without candy coating what the reality is. It's better than it was. It's still nowhere near perfect. And I think this idea that the women who are themselves the mentors are still struggling with these institutional barriers, and they're real people who can both be a role model for somebody who's younger, but can, but also, you know, need support themselves. And what a beautiful program to be able to kind of combine those requirements and those interests.
Well, you know, they really do have that struggle. Like for me, with the Black women in STEM, I'm the one who creates more of the equity type of panel discussions. So there was one that I had that I created. We had an in-person one. And then when COVID hit, we had a webinar on code switching. It was called Code Switching or Soul Switching, meaning how much of your soul do you have to give away in the workplace just to fit in, right? And so, and code switching is big in our communities because a lot of people feel that you still have to code switch. You have to become a second self in the workplace.
For sure. Yeah.
And
yeah.
I have an issue with that. And so, and but then trends are changing where more women are feeling more authentic to in the workplace where they can be themselves. Still, you have the business decorum, but you can still bring your culture into the workplace. So that's one. One of the workshops that I'm doing for our conference, our summit in October, is called Managing While Other. And it is when you are the other. And a lot of times when you are in a supervisor or a management role, how do you navigate through the micro and macro aggressions that you might endure on a daily basis? How do you navigate through that? And this is going to be centered in a tech environment. How do you navigate through that in a tech environment? So that's going to be an interesting panel as well. And so for me, all the sessions that I do around diversity, equity, and inclusion, it's 20% bitching ceremony, 80% solutions.
Mm-hmm. That's great. Yeah, because you need both. You need the catharsis and the community.
How do we change this now, right? How do we start moving forward and change this? And what's your technique that you use that might be able to assist someone else in navigating through, you know, this process? So I'm looking forward to our event in, you know, in October.
I love that. And I'm so glad that we were able to take the time, not just to talk about the need, but also some of the incredible programs that are that you are making available and fostering, both between iUrban Teen and Black Women in STEM 2.0. You know, I'm wondering, Dina, if there's anything that we haven't covered in this time that we've spent together that you wanted to make sure we got out there.
You know, what I do want to get out there is, you know, I'm going to do some shameless promoting here, because we are, we're so excited, myself and my other founding members of Black Women in STEM 2.0, we're so excited about this event in October that I'd love to share if anyone would like to attend or be a sponsor or whatever you want to do. Look us up. You can find our information on our website, which is BWI STEM, short for Black Women in STEM, .com, BWISTEM.com. And then click on the tab that says 2021 Summit, and all the information is there. Also, if you are in Seattle, Portland, Los Angeles, Dallas, Houston, or Harlem, if you would like to volunteer with us at iUrban Teen, you can learn more about us and fill out the volunteer form at iUrbanTeen.org.
Oh, good. So yeah, if you are hearing this, you're getting inspired and you want to get involved, that's exactly how you do it. Well, Dina, you know, before we go, I ask all of my guests the same two closing questions, and I'm definitely interested to hear your responses given the work that you do. They're sort of big picture questions. So are you ready for them?
I guess so.
All right, we'll see. All right. So I want you to think about the future, and you can do that in whatever context is relevant to you. It can be the future of the work that you do, the future of, you know, the community, the future of the globe, the cosmic or much larger future, you know, whatever kind of makes sense to you in this moment. The mm-hmm. first question is, what is the thing that keeps you up the most at night? The thing you're most concerned about, the thing you're most worried about, maybe even a little bit pessimistic or could even be a bit cynical about. But then on the flip side of that, to kind of bring it to a lighter place, the second question is, what are you truly sort of authentically hopeful for? What are you optimistic about and looking forward to?
Well, I would say what keeps me up at night, what keeps me in this space or this space of insecurity is, will there be clear and equitable pathways for my sons, for my grandchildren, for all of these almost 10,000 students that have gone through iUrban Teen? Are they going to thrive well in their lives, in their futures? You know, are they going to be treated equitably? Those are the things that I worry about with our students. I don't worry about me so much as I worry about clear pathways for them. That's why I keep fighting this fight, even when we didn't have funding, you know, trying to continue to build that yellow brick road for them. But then there's the adults. I worry about so many women and people of color still in the workplace that's afraid to advocate for themselves. You know, I think about the future for them and what does that look like? You know, how so many people are suffering in silence because they're afraid to advocate for themselves. You know, when I do speaking engagements, if there's a lot of women or people of color in the room, I ask them how many of them have children. And then I ask them, when your child grows up, do you want them to advocate for themselves and to have their voices heard in the workplace? And they all say yes. Then I ask them, well, why aren't you doing it for yourselves? So look at it that way. Now, what I'm optimistic about is I'm optimistic on how the growth of my program, how many people are getting vested in what we're doing, you know, and how we're going to be thriving with this program and impacting even more lives. You know, we have a camp, a 24-hour day of giving in September 23rd. And our whole campaign is called Bridging the Gap on Education Equity, which bridges the gap on economic development, which bridges the gap on community impact. And it's all true. It's all true. You know, so I'm very optimistic that we're going to continue doing the work that we do and that we are going to be impacting those three pillars.
Hear, hear, as am I. Well, Dina, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with us today.
I thank you. This was fun. And I do talk a lot. So
no, I'm glad. I love a guest who talks a lot. It means I have to do a lot less work.
Oh, girl. Well, thank you for inviting me. I look forward to more conversations with you and all.
Yeah. I definitely look forward to collaborating, a continued collaboration in the future. And everybody who's listening, of course, make sure that you check out the show notes for links that Dina mentioned on the show. And thank you to everybody who's listening for coming back week after week. I'm really looking forward to the next time we all get together to talk nerdy.